Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two segments up tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Yiannis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens, to talk about the Greek elections, a big victory for the left there. What does that mean, if anything? And this following upon the riots in Athens and then elsewhere, echoed elsewhere throughout the country, that happened last December. So what is going on in Greece? Not a country a lot of people in the United States spend a lot of time thinking about, but one on the periphery of Europe, and well worth thinking about, especially if this is a harbinger of things to come elsewhere. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Greg Grandin, who is a professor of history, specializing in Latin America at NYU, and we'll talk to him about what's going on in Honduras, and also a little bit about his, well, now not so new, but still relatively new book, Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City, which was recently published by Metropolitan Books. Mostly we'll talk about Honduras, but we'll get a little Henry Ford in there as well. And before all that, some words on the news. In U.S. economic news, the slow improvement of the U.S. labor market continues. Emphasis on slow, of course, and the baseline of general awfulness upon which this improvement is founded. First-time applications for unemployment insurance fell by 33,000 last week to the lowest level since last November, just as the economy was beginning its descent from a cliff. The four-week moving average of initial claims, which is a better way of looking at these volatile figures, fell by 9,000 to its lowest level since last December. The fly in this particular jar of ointment is that over 500,000 Americans a week are still visiting the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits. While that's down more than 100,000 from its peak last April, it's still quite elevated, nearly twice as high as what we'd see in a strong labor market. And the count of those continuing to draw benefits is edging down, but more slowly, and it remains higher than the first-time series when they're compared to the historical averages. That suggests to me that, as I've been saying here for a while, the pace of job loss continues to slow, but the rate of hiring isn't really picking up. And it's not likely to anytime soon. There's an old rule of thumb in economics called Oken's Law, named after the Kennedy-era economist Arthur Oken, that says that you need about 2 points of GDP growth above a certain baseline level to get the unemployment rate down by a point. That baseline level is thought to be around 2.5%. So to get the unemployment rate down by a point over the next year, we'd need growth of 4.5%. That's quite strong by historical standards, about a point above long-term averages. And we averaged just 2.7% during the 2001 to 2007 expansion, the weakest in modern history. Even what was thought to be a boom in the 1990s, we averaged just 3.6%. Since growth is typically quite weak for a long time after a major financial crisis, it'd be a stretch to expect anything like 4.5% growth in the next year or two. Even if we can get it up to 3.5%, it'd take a year or more to get the unemployment rate down to 9%. So we're likely to see a persistently high level of joblessness even after the U.S. economy starts growing again, which I expect to in a few months. One drag on growth is the constriction of credit. Despite trillions in government aid to the banks, they're not really lending. But then again, a lot of people aren't borrowing. We do have a long-term issue to worry about here. There's too much debt throughout the economy, and we've become way too dependent on fresh extensions of credit to finance growth. With employment weak and wage growth in the doldrums, borrowing is about the only thing that can give consumer spending a kick, but neither borrowers nor lenders seem thrilled at that prospect. On Thursday, the Federal Reserve reported that consumer credit contracted at a 6% annual rate in August, a pretty rapid rate of contraction, and a seventh consecutive month of negative numbers. There are few precedents for this string of declines in modern history, but it's likely we're going to see more of this as we all adjust to less and less borrowing. For an economy that's been dependent on debt-supported consumption, and for a political system that's dependent on high levels of consumption for its legitimation, it's going to be a challenge to make the transition. Another challenge, a spreading panic in the financial markets about the U.S. dollar. The price of gold broke $1,000 recently and has been setting new highs, a sign of investors are distrusting paper assets, especially the kinds with pictures of dead presidents on them. This has several implications. One, the U.S. economy remains highly dependent upon borrowing abroad. During the bubble years, the borrowing was for consumption and housing. Now it's so the federal government can bail us out of the consequences of that bubble. It may well get harder and more expensive to do all that borrowing in the coming months and years. And two, if the aversion to the dollar gets strong enough, the greenback may lose its status as the world's dominant currency, which would make it even harder and more expensive for us to borrow, and would probably make imported goods like oil more expensive than they are now. Countering that negative effect would be a positive one. U.S. exports would be rendered cheaper and therefore more competitive in international markets. But in general, countries with depreciating currencies are in a state of long-term relative decline. Devaluing your way to competitiveness can be the weak link's strategy. So far, though, worry about the international role of the dollar is affecting only the far right, which is using it, and some of the far left, I should say. But the far right is using it as yet another stick to bash Obama, as if Republican administrations had nothing to do with getting us so deep into debt. The coastal elite seem less concerned. As Ken Rogoff, the IMF's former chief economist, who's back to his teaching post at Harvard, told the Financial Times, the financial crisis has probably brought forward the day when the dollar is no longer dominant, but maybe from 75 years to 40 years. Whistling past the graveyard, is he? Or a voice of calm amidst anxious markets and excited political extremes? Answer next week. Okay, let's take a musical break. Some of Grease 2000, original mix by Three Drives on a Vinyl, a trio of DJs from about 10 years ago, and presented by Paul Oakenfold on a Transport collection. And that has nothing to do, at least in sound, with Grease, but I thought the title was a way to introduce this next segment, which is an interview with Yannis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens. And the left won a strong victory in the elections last week, and we'll find out what that all means, if anything. So picked up the phone and dialed Yannis in Athens this morning. And apologies for the very first moment of the interview, cut off the very beginning of his response, but you'll figure it out. Okay, Yannis Varoufakis. Hey, welcome, Yannis. Well, you were here about 10, 11 months ago, and here we are now after an election. The socialists won what appears to be a decisive victory. How much to read into this? Is this the beginning of a trend, or is this just a rejection of the old guys, or how do you interpret it?
A major turn in terms of conventional politics. There was a great shift in the voters' propensities from the right wing towards both the Social Democratic Party, the Socialist Party of Greece, while at the same time the parties of the more conventional left, the Marxist left, retained their power at a time when most commentators were expecting that the left would have collapsed. So it's not an insignificant result from the perspective of serious hardcore politics.
How badly has Greece been hit by the international financial crisis?
Well, not as hard as other places, but everything takes longer in Greece. So the general feeling is that while Greece was maintaining a fairly steady rate of growth, while Britain, Ireland, Hungary and the United States were plunging into the crisis, we were just above zero growth until recently. The feeling is that the long-term effects are going to be very badly felt and that Greece is going to exit the recession a lot longer than the rest of the world.
And did this have any influence on the election results?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. There is no doubt that this collapse of the right-wing vote is a vote of no confidence over the handling of the, inverted commas, of the economy. It was quite manifestly clear, it has been now for at least 3 or 4 months, that the right-wing government just completely lost its capacity to manage the fiscal crisis of the Greek state.
Usage question. Why did you put economy in inverted commas?
Well, because there's no such thing as the economy. I mean, there are many different economies. I mean, what's good for one is not necessarily for another. Profit rates usually climb quite fast during recession. So there is no such thing as a representative agent who can be identified with a mythical economy.
But that's hard to argue with. What has Greek economic policy been like in recent years?
Well, let me summarize it very succinctly, if I can. Since 2004, when the previous right-wing government was elected to office, what they did was to reduce the taxes for the rich. That's very straightforward. They effectively waived all taxes on dividends and reduced the top personal tax rate, while at the same time boosting inexorably indirect taxation. So there was a major shift in the distribution of the tax burden from the haves to the have-nots, while at the same time there was a shrinking of the tax base. So the capacity of the state to collect taxes was reduced at a time when the burden of taxation was being shifted from rich to poor. While the Greek economy was growing at a healthy rate of between 4 and 5% from 2004 to 2007, that was sufficient, that growth, to maintain the finances of the state, tax collection, at the level which was sustainable. But when last year the financial crisis hit and growth went down to zero or to minus 0.5 or something like that, then the already shrinking tax base as a result of the removal of taxes that hit the rich just collapsed completely and utterly, and the deficit, the government deficit, blew up from 4% to what I would expect it to be announced later on this week to be around 10 to 12%.
And what about the job market? Unemployment up, employment down?
Absolutely. The Trade Unions Council has estimated that unemployment over the last year has climbed from 7 to more than 15%. Very straightforward.
And now the Socialist Party, of course, a lot of the Social Democratic parties of Western Europe have been just as aggressively neoliberal as many of their conservative counterparts, the Labour Party in Britain, probably the most prominent example, but reproduced across the continent. How does the Greek Socialist Party compare with those?
Well, it's not too dissimilar in the sense that the Greek Socialist Party, when they were in power in the 1990s and early in 2000s, they had adopted the neoliberal mantra of privatization, of deregulation, of moving towards more flexible labor markets, while at the same time retaining a kind of corporatist commitment to increasing social welfare benefits. That commitment departed with the loss of government in 2004 and the election of the right-wing party. While in opposition, since 2004, the Socialist Party has undergone a major transformation. There have been various factions fighting for supremacy within the Socialist Party. The ruling group that has coalesced around its leader, George Papandreou, who is currently the Prime Minister after he won the election last week, is a hodgepodge. There are representatives of different factions, different viewpoints. But I very much suspect that on issues of economic policy and issues that pertain to the extent to which this government is going to toe the neoliberal line or not, the Ministry of Finance is going to have the final word on that. The minister is a young person who has not declared his position on these issues. Personally, I would expect that he will toe the European Union line, which is mainly the Franco-German line on the importance of squeezing deficits out of the picture. If that happens, I think it will be catastrophic. This is my personal view, but it's not clear what his position is going to be on this. He's only been in the job for 2 days now.
So they really haven't released any kind of detailed agenda about dealing with the economic crisis?
None whatsoever. This was part of the strategy. Part of the strategy was to simply allow the right-wing government to collapse by dwelling on their contradictions and incompetence without spelling out what it is that they are going to do. Let's face it, the degrees of freedom that the Greek government has are very limited within the Greek polity. When you have monetary policy being ruled by the European Central Bank, effectively you don't have a central bank of your own, and you have only fiscal policy to play with, and you are in a deficit situation, and you have the European Union trying to impose very strict limits on further spending, there is very little that you can do domestically.
Greece had been in trouble with the EU over some dodgy accounting and sloppy public finances. What's happening with that?
Well, this is a very interesting story. In 2004, when the socialists lost office, the new right-wing government did something which I think is probably unique in the annals of world history. They dobbed the country into the European Union. They went to Brussels and said, you know what, the previous guys were cooking the books, and we're here to clean up and own up. And we will go through a six-month period of national accounting, and we will tell you what the real figures were. That caused dismay in Brussels, because this is not the kind of thing that they're used to. To the extent, of course, that Brussels was supposed to be also supervising what the previous Greek government was doing. In the end, it was all politicking. It was the new government, 2004, trying to secure and enhance its political triumph in the 2004 election by kicking the opposition while it was down, by effectively telling the whole world, and primarily in order to tell the Greek polity, the Greek voters, that the previous guys were far worse than anyone thought. Now, interestingly, Eurostat, which is the statistical service of the European Union, said, yes, thank you, we will be very pleased to hear your story as to what the real numbers are. The accounting procedure led to an increase in the Greek government's estimates of Greek debt ratios for the period of 1999 to 2004. But then Eurostat, 2 years later, came back and said, excuse us, the previous government was using the very same models of financial accounting that the rest of Europe is using. So can you please go back to those? They were okay. So it was just a case of internal politicking, which created an incredibly bad image for the Greek government, the Greek state. It is not, of course, that national accounting here in Greece is spick and span and all clean and above board, but it's not worse than German or French or Italian accounting.
Although some people at the center of the EU think that the countries in the periphery are a little bit suspicious anyway, don't they?
Of course they are, sure. But they're not far more so than they are with regard to Italy, for instance, or even to Belgium. Because if you look at the Belgian situation, it's actually worse than the Greek situation. I suspect that the fact that Greece was a late member of the European Union, and also there's a whole history of Orientalism and of associating Greece with the Ottoman Empire, makes it easier to take shots at the Greek situation. But generally speaking, the European Union has a great deal of trouble in different spots, including in the northern parts of its territory.
I'm speaking with Yannis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens. What can you tell us about the general structure of the Greek economy? What's the industrial makeup? What kinds of jobs do people have?
Well, I think the primary aspect of it is that it's not a fully developed capitalist economy, in the sense that the formal sector, the formal private sector, occupies a relatively small percentage of economic activity. There is still a large rural sector. There are still people who oscillate between the private sector and the informal sector. There is a considerable public sector. In the last 10, 15 years, there's been a major development drive, which has been primarily supported by 1 million illegal refugees, illegal migrants to Greece. They have boosted productivity enormously and allowed Greek businesses to seek new possibilities for growth. And that also created a drive for Greek capital to move to the Balkans. So you have firms that have become sort of international in the sense that they have opened up shop in Bulgaria and in Albania and in Romania and so on and so forth. So it's an interesting amalgam of a modern capitalist economy, an old agrarian Mediterranean rural sector, a state sector which is a relic of the 19th century, pockets of extreme dynamism as in services as well as in software design. It's a genuinely mixed picture.
And what has membership in the euro done for Greece? You mentioned earlier that Greece has no central bank of its own, but what have the strictures of membership in the eurozone done to the Greek economy?
Well, there is a major pro and a major con. The major advantage is that we don't have to worry about depreciation of the currency. So when the financial markets were crashing all over us last year, had we not been in the eurozone, every property owner, everyone with a little bit of money in the bank would be worried that the value of their assets would disappear. That was not the case. Everybody got to bed happy with the thought that, if anything, their assets would be appreciating vis-a-vis the United States assets. There was a price to pay for this, a major price to pay for this. It's a drive. There is a genuine deflationary effect of the fact that we have the euro. By this I mean that just because the gradual loss of the competitiveness of Greek goods and services vis-à-vis the German and the Chinese and so on cannot be accounted for, cannot be ameliorated through the depreciation of the Greek currency, because there is no Greek currency. What is happening is that there is effective wage deflation. So the role that the depreciation of the Greek drachma was playing in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s now is being played by effective reductions in real wages. And that leads to a depressed home market. So we have a slow-burning real recession when it comes to the activities that affect the vast majority of the population, and we have a small segment of Greek society which has found a way of linking itself to the international circuits of capital, and they're doing incredibly well. So one of a repercussion of this is skyrocketing income inequality.
Is there anything the government could do about it if it wanted to, and of course, is it likely to?
Well, I'm sure that they have good intentions. I know some of the people, and the Minister of National Economy is a colleague of mine. She's a professor at the University, Luca Cazzelli. I'm sure she has the best intentions. They're talking about reshaping the tax burden, introducing again taxes on dividends and reducing the tax burden on the poor and doing something about indirect taxes. They have an interesting plan for reducing the capacity of banks to extract compound interest on poor people who have no capacity to repay personal and credit card loans. They have a series of measures which they will try out, but what my great fear is that the fiscal position of Greece, its capacity to borrow in the international money markets, at decent interest rates is going to deteriorate within the next few months. So the good intentions that this government may have may come to naught if in the next few months the whole thing explodes in their hands. If they manage to maintain a steady course in terms of fiscal policy and the spreads in interest rates to not explode in their hands in the next 10, 12 months, some of those measures, as long as they retain them in their, you know, as part of their platform and they enact them, they may make some difference. But the danger is that this government may not be able to survive for very long, and that its very large popularity now is going to disappear overnight if, as I said, the Greek state goes bankrupt.
Some wits on Wall Street were saying that there's a risk that what they're calling the pigs, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, some of those countries, one or some of them, might leave the euro area. Do you think there's any risk of that?
One never knows. I wouldn't think so, because one of the interesting institutional aspects of the Eurozone and the European Union is that there is a mechanism for somebody to get in, but there is no mechanism for someone to get out. An institutional mechanism, I mean. So it's not clear at all how a country would exit Eurozone without creating tumult in the Eurozone itself. So if you take into consideration that Greece is small fry, if you look at it as a percentage, the size of its economy, the size of its debt, compared to the deficits of Britain, of France, of Germany, and so on, I would have thought that it would be more trouble to the Germans and to the French to have Greece expelled from the Eurozone than it would be worth to do them. My worry is that, let's say that someone, that President Obama, let's say, for argument's sake, decides to become incredibly generous to Greece and pay off our national debt tomorrow. The worry is, what will happen next? Would there be any mechanism by which the Greek economy could create a path for itself that would avoid returning to exactly the same spot in which it finds itself now, 10 years hence?
Finally, when you were on here on the show in December of last year, there had just been some nationwide very dramatic riots across Greece. What were the results of that? Did this have any lasting political effect?
Absolutely. I think that the collapse of the right-wing parties, the combination of the right-wing parties, the center-right government plus the neo-fascist party called Laos, if you add their percentage up, it has gone down significantly. I think that to a very large extent, the unraveling of the right wing's dominance, because this time in last year, the right wing was dominant in Greece, began with the December riots in Athens.
Looking at this economic crisis, it's been striking how little in the way of political repercussions there have been. Is Greece perhaps the beginning of a new trend where there is some sort of at least possibly constructive political reaction?
Well, one hopes. Germany is the most worrying link in that chain because there was a coalition government, and it seems that even though it had a very clear and united line, the coalition between the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats, it seems that all the anger of the electorate was directed against the junior member of that coalition. So the right wing, who was, of course, the party out of which the chancellor came, emerged as the party that was trusted the most. So it didn't happen in Germany. France has had a presidential election quite recently, so it won't be a while before we see any such repercussion there. But Britain had a Labour Party in government, so we can only move in the opposite direction in that part of the world. The news that Berlusconi may be facing court changes the scene slightly in Italy, but just to conclude my long-winded answer, I'm not very hopeful about the European Union in terms of the capacity of its polity to react intelligently to what is a momentous financial crisis of capitalism.
And that was the voice of Yannis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens in Greece, talking about political developments in that country. Let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back to talk about Latin America.
My name is Jacqueline Murekatete, a Rwandan genocide survivor and activist, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York City. Nitwa Jacqueline Murekatete ndo mureskape ya genocide y'Abatutsi yabaye muri 1994 mu Rwanda. Murimo kumva WBAI at 99.5 FM hano mu mujyi wa New York.
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 in your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, don't be averse to clicking the donate button. We'll be doing some fundraising soon, but it's never too early to start. Okay, let's take a musical break, and then we'll be back to talk with Greg Grandin. That was the three-part invention in C major, BWV 787, by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by András Schiff. And now we're joined by Greg Grandin, a professor of history at NYU. And I just learned, reading his CV this afternoon, he's a full professor. Congratulations. Congratulations, Greg. We're honored to have you on the line here.
As opposed to a half-professor.
Right. No half-professors around here, only the full kind. He specializes in Latin America, author most recently of the book Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City, and I do want to talk a little bit about that later on. Don't have the time for a full-blown treatment, but I did overlook this one when it first came out, but now I want to do a little reparation for that oversight. But most immediate concern is Honduras. So, Greg, what is going on in Honduras right now? It's very hard to follow precisely what's going on in that country after the. How long has it been since the coup?
Well, the coup since June 28th, so well into the fourth month, and the most recent event, of course, is Manuel Zelaya, the deposed president. Coming back into the country clandestinely and making it to the Brazilian embassy, where he's been for about 3 weeks. I think it'll be 3 weeks on Monday. And there's been a standoff. And recently, yesterday, a delegation from the Organization of American States has arrived in the country to try to broker an end to the crisis. But of course, the coup government, Roberto Michelete, the self-installed president, is being fairly intransigent, using the negotiations as a way to buy time and stall, but really not giving any ground about the key demand, and that's the restoration of Zelaya.
I saw that right wing nut, Jim DeMint, the senator from South Carolina, who's sort of taken the lead on the right wing of this stuff, on Fox the other night, and he was just frothing at the traitorous behavior of the Brazilians and greasing his reentry into the country. What's Brazil's role been in this?
Well, Brazil has been great. You know, in general, Ignacio Lula da Silva has been very good on this issue. There's speculation that he possibly knew that Zelaya was going to make it to the Brazilian embassy, or even if he didn't, he's certainly been steadfast. Jim DeMint has really been in the point on this, really trying to use it as a wedge. And of course, the Obama administration has let it drag on. The longer they let it drag on, the more it becomes a right-wing rallying cry. I mean, you see, it's over Honduras that DeMint is holding up, has put a freeze on Obama's two main foreign policy appointments in Latin America: the ambassador to Brazil, Thomas Shannon, and the ambassador to all of Latin America, Assistant Secretary of State in Western Hemisphere Affairs, Arturo Valenzuela.
And then, of course, the
nominations are both frozen because of Honduras.
And these Contra-era ghouls are back in the scene, too, like Otto Reich, right?
Yeah. Otto Reich is involved in all sorts of machinations in Latin America, mostly through this kind of democracy promotion, International Republican Institute, which is basically new forms of destabilization, but overtly. It's what led to the overthrow of Aristide in Haiti, what almost led to the overthrow of Chavez in 2002 and Evo Morales in Bolivia in 2008. He was involved working in Honduras through a democracy promotion organization around issues of transparency and corruption that really was singularly focused on destabilizing Zelaya's government.
I love the idea of democracy promotion supporting a coup.
The left has socialism for the 21st century. The right has democracy for the 21st century, and basically it is it's an attempt to put a constitutional procedural veneer on what's an old-style coup. I mean, what is different about this coup is that they immediately handed it over to supposedly, nominally civilian control and tried to justify it in procedural terms. But I think anybody who knows anything about Latin American politics sees this for what it is, and that was a coup.
Well, let's step back, and what is it that exercised the Honduran and American right so much about Zelaya's rule?
Well, Zelaya was elected a few years ago as a center-rightist, a moderate. It comes out of the Liberal Party. Basically, Honduras has been ruled either by somebody from the Liberal Party or the National Party since the 1860s, except for in periods of military rule. And, I mean, we complain about our two-party system not being democratic, but this is really not democratic. I mean, this is really just a small group of elites that trade power back and forth. And Zelaya began to move away from that for whatever reasons, whatever his motivation was. Maybe it was just...
Were there any popular movements pushing him?
There were popular movements pushing him, but they were small. Honduras, I mean, they were pretty decimated during the Cold War, not directly, not like in other countries, but they were contained. But there are unions, and there are peasant movements. There's a strong environmentalist movement linked to the progressive wing of the Catholic Church, and all of these movements were pushing Zelaya. And one of Zelaya's main sins, at least according to the elites, was that he presumed to consult with these movements in his governance. And then he did a number of other things. He raised the minimum wage. He banned open-pit mining. He passed a number of other environmental laws, basically working with the progressive church and the environmentalists. And then what the real kicker, I mean, people say that it was about this, about the constitutional convention that he was trying to organize around. But the real kicker was that he refused to ban the morning after pill about 2 weeks before his coup. He vetoed Michelete in Congress when he was the head of Congress, pushed through this very draconian law that was trying to criminalize the morning after pill. This is a big deal in Central America, where abortion is still very, there's a lot of punitive laws against it, even among the left.
The Sandinistas have not been very enlightened in this particular
country. No, and that's a good contrast to show you how controversial it is and how radical Zelaya was. He also promoted sex education in public schools, so that really got the Opus Dei wing of the Catholic Church in alignment with the evangelical wing, conservative evangelicals, and along with this move towards aligning Honduran foreign policy with Venezuela, with Bolivia, with Ecuador, with the populist left, and then trying to organize around a non-binding referendum to see if Hondurans wanted to be able to vote on the possibility of reforming the Constitution after Zelaya would have stepped down, because he wasn't trying to extend his term. That's what provoked, that was the straw that broke the camel's back for the right.
And this, of course, is the pretext on which democracy promotion of a coup is based, right?
Yeah, and they say, I mean, Oscar Arias, the president of Honduras, Costa Rica, he was tapped to negotiate a settlement by Hillary Clinton called the Honduran Constitution the worst in the world because it's contradictory. It has missions. It doesn't have an impeachment process. And basically, because it doesn't have an impeachment process, that's how Michelete and the military are justifying the fact that they roused Zelaya out of bed in his pajamas at the point of guns and put him on a plane and sent him to Costa Rica because they didn't have an impeachment process, therefore they couldn't impeach him. They had to just throw him out. That's the justification.
That's pretty amazing. I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, professor of history at NYU, and author most recently of the book Fordlandia from Metropolitan Books. So who are the social forces behind the coup? Landowners and the military?
Landowners, a lot of the, maquila owners, the kind of assembly processing plants in San Pedro Sula, that's a big center around that.
They don't like that minimum wage increase?
They didn't like the minimum wage increase. The conservative wing of the Catholic Church, in many ways, the Catholic Church in other areas of South America has evolved since the 1980s, but in Honduras, it's almost like a frozen snapshot of the 1980s. You have the progressive wing, who are steadfast behind Zelaya. A priest is locked in the embassy with Zelaya, Andre Tamayo, right now as we speak. And then you have the Opus Dei, Da Vinci Code wing of the Catholic Church that is now in alliance with very conservative evangelical movements. You have the military, which had its own interests and is basically runs the shadow government, is very invested in all sorts of criminal activities and illegal operations. And then, of course, you have the media. Naomi Klein called Venezuela in 2002 a media coup, and this is also a media coup. It adheres exactly to that description. I mean, media in Honduras is corporate slash oligarch owned, and there's not a shred of professionalism.
And what can we understand of popular opinion, and how much does that matter?
Well, I think it matters a lot. I mean, a poll just came out 2 days ago by a respected Honduran pollster that shows Zelaya to be the most popular politician in the country, that the Hondurans oppose the coup 3-1. They support Zelaya something like 3-1. So I don't know if this was the state of public opinion 3 months ago, but certainly the repressive aspects, the repressive face of the coup, which has come out over the last couple of months, and particularly since Zelaya has been back in the country, has pushed public opinion in that direction.
What's the international reaction been? Have most countries recognized this, or are most countries resisting it?
Well, most countries have said that they're not going to, that they reject the Micheletti government. They won't recognize it. They're insisting on Zelaya returning. The European Union, the Organization of American States, most South American countries, most Central American countries, Mexico. And the big thing, of course, is the scheduled elections coming up on the end of November, November 29th. That they were scheduled prior to the coup. The question is, the coup government was hoping to get to that election, hold those elections, establish facts on the ground, and then eventually everybody would come around to recognizing whoever won that election, which was either going to be somebody from the National Party or the Liberal Party, probably the National Party because Zelaya's coup split the Liberal Party. But Zelaya's return has preempted that. I mean, the coup government now has two choices as they get closer and closer to November 29th. They can negotiate a settlement and let Zelaya symbolically return to the presidency, but then that will empower the social movements behind him and discredit the people who carried out the coup, or they can proceed to have the elections with Zelaya either hunkered down in the Brazilian embassy, causing all sorts of problems, arrested or given asylum and safe passage out of the country. All of those things, I think, discredit the elections. And the U.S. government has been very ambivalent in sending mixed messages, but recently they've increasingly been consistent on saying they're not going to recognize the elections under these conditions.
What has the position of the U.S. government been? They've been, you said, back and forth. Then the Obama administration is getting pressured from the right to support the coup. Are they speaking with a clear voice, or are they typically trying to find a middle ground of mush, as they often do?
Well, I think that typically trying to find a middle ground. I mean, Obama said a few good things immediately right out of the gate about calling it a coup and off the cuff and demanding Zelaya's return. The State Department has been more played a more ambivalent role. Hillary Clinton has ties, obviously, to both the neoconservative right and the neoliberal right, who is very invested. People like Lonnie Davis, the pollster. I mean, lobbyist who was hired by the Honduran business elite to lobby for the coup in the United States.
Yeah, the Times, New York Times, had a story about all these lobbying connections. They're spending a fortune on lobbying, and they're hiring some very well-connected folks, including that snake Lanny Davis.
And they're basically, I mean, talk about trying to put lipstick on a pig. I mean, it's been a pretty repressive. 14 people have been killed. They rounded up hundreds of people. During one stretch a couple of weeks back, they were holding them in the national soccer, the city soccer stadium, Tegucigalpa soccer stadium, which of course invokes Pinochet. There's reports of torture, there's harassment. I mean, they've closed down pretty much every alternative source of media in the country. It's a hard regime to make look good. So despite all of the spending money on these lobbyists and public relations firms, and despite the fact that the right has lined up with the coup mongers, it's not really playing well, I think.
What about the right? I mean, people like DeMint, what's their interest in it? Is they just trying to beat Obama over the head with something else?
I think so. I think that's what it is. I think, you know, the historical parallel is obviously the late 1970s, where Carter's ambiguous or ambivalent stance towards the Sandinistas and towards the Central and Nicaragua and the Central American left in general kind of opened a breach in which the new right could really point out the inconsistencies, point out the ineffectualness of Carter's foreign policy. And the same thing has happened. The longer this drags out, the more Obama allows the right to draw these connections. I mean, I don't know if you noticed during the last teabagger rally down in Washington, there were quite a lot of placards linking Obama to Chavez, to Castro, and to Honduras.
Yeah. Now, how accurate is this? This kind of axis of evil that they were positing in Latin America. How close was Zelaya to the real bad guys like Chavez?
Well, he was drawing. You know, he entered into Petrocaribe, which was a petroleum alliance in which Venezuela advances cheap credit in order for poor countries to buy Venezuelan oil, because Venezuela is a member of OPEC. They can't sell the oil below cost, below whatever OPEC sets, but they can, or below market price, but they can advance cheap credit, long-term cheap credit, which is what Petrocaribe does. And it's a huge boost for countries like Honduras and Guatemala and Bolivia and Ecuador that need that kind of support. But he was also drawing close to Brazil, and I think Brazil's support of Zelaya over the last couple of weeks and months have indicated that framing of Latin American politics between left, good and bad, just doesn't hold. I mean, now you have DeMint going crazy about Lula, but Lula is supposed to be the good leftist.
Yeah, well, they're not known for their fine distinctions.
Yeah, yeah.
But what's in it for Brazil? Why are they taking this position?
Well, this is the way I like to think about it. In 2008, South America, not Latin America, South America had two major crises that South American governments resolved on their own without the help of the United States. One was when Colombia attacked Ecuador and everybody mobilized, Venezuela mobilized troops, Ecuador mobilized troops, a regional summit in South America led by Brazil, but also other countries like Chile settled that. Then when the separatist movement in Bolivia in late 2008 tried to destabilize Bolivia, South American countries got together in Santiago, Chile, and let it be known that they were not going to accept any destabilization of Evo, and that ended that crisis. Then when this crisis broke out 3 months ago, I kind of feel like South America gave the United States one more chance to solve a crisis. Said, okay, this is yours, you could solve it. And it was a complete disaster. They sent mixed messages, they wouldn't work through the Organization of American States, they tapped Oscar Arias to try to, Costa Rican president, to try to settle it. As the failure of the United States to resolve the crisis became more and more evident, Brazil has stepped up and taken the lead in organizing opposition and organizing a condemnation and pressure on Honduras. I think it's a regional hegemon asserting its authority in the region.
And is there some sort of vacuum now of American power that Brazil is able to take advantage of?
Yeah, and I think that's fairly clear. As I said, those two last crises in 2008, the U.S. was nowhere to be found and had no play in it, no role at all in its settlement.
Why is that? Tensions distracted?
Well, I think it's distracted. I think there's very conditions that make Latin America the perfect place if Obama actually wanted to step up and put into place the so-called new multilateralism, a new internationalism that he and people like Susan Rice say they stand for, say they want to put into place. Latin America would be that Western Hemisphere would be the perfect place to put it into place. But the very same conditions that make it an optimal venue, that there are no major threats to U.S. resources. Venezuela continues to sell oil to the United States. There's no imminent threat of nuclear weapons. Also makes it a place where you don't want to put up a lot of capital, and you don't want to really invest a lot of political capital in trying to overcome some of these failed diplomatic policies towards the region. And so the U.S. is kind of withdrawn. It kind of has retrenched in some way. You can almost imagine it geographically. It's really betting its power on creating a security corridor between Colombia, Central America, and Mexico as the rest of South America kind of pulls out of its orbit and diversifies its economics, diversifies its politics with the rest of the world, with China, obviously, but the Middle East, with Russia, with Europe.
Well, this is quite a departure from the time when the United States looked at Latin America as our backyard, as they say.
Not just our backyard, but the U.S. tended to administer Latin America as a single unit. When one country or another tried to break out of the region, the U.S. acted unilaterally to bring it to heel or to isolate it, Guatemala, Chile, Cuba. But for the most part, it treated Latin America as Latin America. And what you're seeing more and more as the United States is a kind of recessional hegemon is that it is betting its power. One, it's retrenching. It's resorting to some kind of geographic notion of national security, trying to build a security corridor running from Mexico down to Colombia. And on the other hand, it's playing a kind of divide and rule game, building bases in Colombia, those seven military bases in Colombia. So it is an indication of weakness.
I've only got another minute to go because I have to get out of here early. But where do you see this going?
Well, I don't know. As I said, I have no idea what I mean. The people who carried out the coup really backed themselves into a corner. And again, the stupidity of them is evident when you realize that in November 29th, a conservative candidate, either from the Liberal Party or the National Party, was going to win that election no matter what. And that would have doused whatever restlessness that Zelaya stirred up with his reforms. Now they've got themselves they have Zelaya, who is the most popular politician in the country, hunkered down in the Brazilian embassy. They're internationally isolated. They're resorting to more and more repression in order to maintain rule, which will undermine their undermined their ability to consolidate power. And you see members of the coup coalition kind of pulling out or distancing themselves from Michelete. I think that, I don't know, maybe I'm optimistic, but I think maybe there's a couple of weeks left before Zelaya is restored symbolically.
All right, you got to bring it to a close there. Thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Greg Grandin, and I never got a chance to talk to you about Fordlandia. So when the paperback comes out, we'll do that.
Okay.
The tale of Henry Ford's vast schemes in the Amazon, published by Metropolitan Books. Greg Grandin, also professor, full professor at NYU. Thanks, Greg. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. And let's go out with this, speaking of coups, my coup d'etat. From Being Selfish. Bye.
While you were all asleep, my tanks came creeping down your street. While you were dreaming, I was scheming. I've been conspiring, inspiring, plotting and desiring. I've been bribing, deriding, constantly undermining. Now it's time for proclamations. Exactly. assassination, 'cause this is my coup d'etat.